I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE on the very day the 1948 Genocide Convention was adopted by the United Nations. Tomorrow, Israeli criminal Netanyahu is scheduled to defend himself in a Jewish court against charges of corruption, not genocide. This as NATO nations with Israel and Al-Qaeda try to continue their extermination of Arabs. In Syria, at least, Russia on today's Heroes of the Fatherland Day will be seeking to wipe out MI6, CIA, Mossad-backed Al-Qaeda. But as for Lebanon and the Holy Land, Christmas, destroyed by Washington power, looks bleak. Joining me now from the U.S. state of Pennsylvania is Susan Abulawa, best-selling author of the novels Mornings in Jenin, The Blue Between Sky and Water and Against the Loveless World. Abulawa is also the founder of Playgrounds for Palestine, an initiative bringing rare moments of joy to children living under EU, U.S., U.K. armed Israeli occupation. Susan, thanks so much for coming on. I better first ask what Playgrounds for Palestine is for our audience, because horribly, the word playground is now associated with mass graves and Israeli soldiers armed by Britain and the United States playing in playgrounds and executing children.
Hi, Afshin. Thanks for having me. Playgrounds for Palestine was conceived as an initiative to bring recreation and joy to children. We have, for the past year, diverted all of our resources towards a school that we started in Gaza, because this is the second year now that children have been out of school. So we are trying to, you know, just continue education as much as possible for as many children as we can.
I mean, it's amazing to even talk about schools, obviously, amidst the famine and the flooding this winter in Gaza. You, I understand, were at the Oxford Union, famous for hosting Malcolm X, of course, in its day. What's it like being at the Oxford Union in a country, Britain, which is actively participating in the genocide because it's flying the spy flights from Cyprus? I know you've characterized it previously as being subject to theatrics, bullying, screaming, and insults.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned Malcolm X, because that was kind of the reason that I went. I mean, you know, I think that the people on the opposition team were kind of beneath us, to be honest. I mean, they are genocide advocates. And as I mentioned in my opening remarks, I did go there in the spirit of Malcolm X and also James Baldwin, who was in a similar debate at Cambridge, both of them facing criminals who adhere to racist ideologies, just like Zionism.
Yeah, I mean, clearly in Britain, and there are many exceptions, there have been mass demonstrations in solidarity with Palestine. We mustn't forget that. But the newspaper I began my career on, The Guardian, I understand, are they facilitating the Holocaust in Gaza? They recently banned an article by you about Palestine?
I mean, I think the Western media in general is complicit, if not active participants in this genocide. I mean, the evidence is pretty damning for not just The Guardian, but for the BBC, The New York Times, CNN, MSNBC, all of them. They are all complicit in whitewashing Israeli crimes, in covering up what's actually happening on the ground, in discounting the voices and the reportage of Palestinian journalists who are on the ground, who get all the credit for ensuring that this genocide, this Holocaust, did not happen in the dark, which is what Israel clearly wanted to happen when they cut off all internet and communication and banned journalists, Western journalists, from entering the Gaza Strip, and then proceeded to assassinate journalists. I mean, it's the largest cohort of assassinated journalists in any conflict in modern times, in recorded history, I believe. So the incident with the Guardian was ultimately about, you know, sort of things broke down over the use of the word Holocaust, I was asked to write a piece for a series that was running in The Guardian. I was skeptical that they would run anything I wrote because I, you know, voices.
Because
like
you're a novelist and running an NGO. No, why?
Well, no, it's because I'm uncompromising in what I say. I think they like to have articles by Palestinians who are willing to soften their voice and just to, you know, just to be heard. And I wasn't willing to do that. I did compromise on some edits, and then things finally broke down because I refused to remove the word Holocaust.
Even though we have seen the pictures of burned children as part of the ethnic cleansing.
It's more than burned children. I mean, it's burned children, burning alive of whole families, burying alive of, I mean, most children are dying a most gruesome, horrific death of being buried in the rubble, unable to move, unable to breathe. And that takes, you know, that kind of suffocation of being buried alive takes anywhere from 10 to 15 minutes to die. And if you can imagine the horror, the terror that individuals, children, whole families go through before they die, that's happening en masse throughout Gaza. And children are being sniped. That's been well documented. It's the largest cohort of pediatric amputees anywhere in the world. You know, our society is utterly devastated by this colonial monstrosity that the West planted in our midst.
Yeah, and The Guardian's a British newspaper. Sir Keir Starmer, obviously intimately involved with the genocide. I mean, we invite him on. Kath Viner, the editor of The Guardian, we invite her on. Her predecessor, Alan Rusbridger, was on the show. I know Julian Assange's WikiLeaks weren't that happy about him being on the show because of the way The Guardian treated WikiLeaks, but we do invite her in. You say, having been to Gaza, that for all the heroic journalism, and there has been such heroic journalism from Gaza, you say the reality is infinitely worse on the ground. Tell me why.
To be honest, I have not...
You were there twice this year.
I was. And I still cannot find the right words to capture the enormity of the horror. And that's something that I've heard, we've all heard from people, from doctors, from other NGO workers who have been there. They come out saying, like, I just don't have the words to explain, because, and that's a feeling, that's something we all feel. On the one hand, there is this kind of spectacular violence, for lack of a better word, that is that's horrifying, and that is pervasive. But there's also this this constant, chronic, mass deprivation, degradation of society. Gaza and Palestinians in general managed to become a high functioning society despite all of the hardships and all of the restrictions that Israel has placed on us. For example, you know, education in our society comes at a premium. I mean, you ask me why we're having schools when people are hungry, because this is our society. We value education, and Palestinians had built universities under impossible conditions. And so on the one hand, you had people who were planning to open businesses, to pursue their PhDs, to get married, to build a house. And now the ceiling of people's ambitions is just to get enough water for the day. And this massive degradation of people, of families, of societies, the breakdown, the disease, the filth, the hunger, the thirst, the insecurity, the fear, the trauma, this accumulation of this incremental accumulation of horror upon horror upon horror that just does not abate. It does not let it, there's no place to run. It is this tiny place, like a fishbowl, that Israel shoots into at will and commits the most horrific atrocities with impunity, seeming impunity, and nothing seems to be stopping them.
But you're in the United States, so what does it make you feel when you see the ceasefire being vetoed at the UN Security Council and more and more arms with each week are being supplied and manufactured where you live to carry out the genocide?
Yeah, exactly. And honestly, a lot of us are actually leaving the United States precisely for that reason. It's just, there's a big part of me that I wish I never left Gaza. I think I feel like I would rather be there despite all of the threats because the world feels like a big lie outside of Gaza. And one cannot escape the feeling of complicity just and also of guilt, survivor's guilt. So, you know, why do I get to live in safety, and why do I get to have ample food? And especially when, you know, you have all of these images and these people you love who are suffering so profoundly.
I mean, what do you think of the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, who appears every few months saying he's trying his best while the arms are being sent there and poured in to wipe out and exterminate?
Anthony Blinken is a Zionist. I believe his first loyalty is actually to Israel, like so many Zionists who have gotten themselves and planted themselves in positions of power throughout this administration, previous administrations, throughout Congress, throughout the media, throughout Hollywood. I mean, I do not believe for one second that their loyalty is to the United States. It's not even a dual loyalty. It is a single loyalty to Israel. And Anthony Blinken himself, when he went to Israel, said, you know, I'm here as a Jew. I mean, it's the chutzpah of doing that. Can you imagine a Muslim saying that? I'm not here as an American. I'm here as a Muslim. The media would never let that fly. But I think that Zionists in this country have extraordinary control over foreign policy. I believe they are dictating foreign policy. That does not absolve Biden or Harris or anyone else. I think Blinken is playing a massive role in perpetuating this genocide, I think, and in the incoming administration as well. I mean, Jared Kushner has a great deal of control and influence in what happens, as he did in the previous Trump administration. He is an avowed Zionist. He has talked about removing Palestinians because and taking over what he called valuable shorefront property. I mean, these people are—they're depraved. They are depraved.
I should just say, Kushner doesn't have a role, as far as we know, at the time of this interview, though his dad does in Paris, as far as I understand. But Susan Abulhawa, I'll stop you there. More from the best-selling author of Mornings in Jenin and founder of Playgrounds for Palestine after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the best-selling author of Mornings in Jenin and founder of Playgrounds for Palestine, Susan Abulhawa. Susan, you won't find the British Medical Lancet Journal, the July estimate of 186,000 killed, mostly women and children, in NATO propaganda media. But you, I understand, believe, having been to Gaza, that it could be as high as half a million, maybe, by now. I mean, that's proportionally equivalent to wiping out 160 million Americans. What do you think about the scale of the slaughter, and is it being covered there in the United States in terms of percentages? Because these are unprecedented numbers, aren't they, as for a population?
So I, of course, it's not being covered in the United States. The about 10 days prior to the Lancet article, I did a study myself. I am a scientist, but before I was a writer, I was a scientist, and I still am. I used the things I witnessed. I used other data that I gathered, and I used data from various human rights organizations who are on the ground in Gaza, including the UN, Euromed, the WHO, and others, and using morbidity and mortality rates for known diseases, I calculated the number or the range of the most likely death toll accordingly. So you have, of course, the direct murder, which has been calculated precisely, actually, by the Palestinian Ministry of Health. And there's also a number of missing Palestinians, most of them presumed dead. So those were the those are kind of the direct number of casualties. But you have this much larger casualty figure that's related to the withholding of medication, the new diseases, etc. So there are a lot of chronic diseases, as in any population, including diabetes and various cardiovascular diseases, kidney disease, certain genetic disorders that require particular diets and things like that. So this entire population has been really hugely affected, very adversely so. And there's a percentage of that population has died or is expected to die because of lack of medication for these chronic conditions. And so that's another population. There's also the people who are dying of malnutrition, most of them children and very vulnerable individuals, people who are dependent on dialysis or cancer patients who cannot get treatment. I mean, those are that population is also getting wiped out because there's just no facilities left or treatment for them. So there's multiple populations like that. And when you add it all up, when you calculate the rates of mortality based on known rates that are available in the literature, in scientific literature, you can somewhat come up with a statistical number. And I did that. I came up with a range that was between 194,000 to 514,000 people killed as a result. And there's also, like, of course, the rate of infection post-operative infection is quite high because there are no antibiotics really being let in. And then 10 days after that, of course, as with the media, the way they typically do is to ignore Palestinian voices. And so my study was ignored until 10 days later, when The Lancet published an estimate of 186,000 people dead, which I believe is still an underestimation. But that, corresponds to the lower end of the range that I predicted. I do think when the dust settles that we will find probably 500,000, at least maybe, 10% of the population having been wiped out. And of course, the population of those who have been maimed and injured is even larger. So,
or a quarter of the population, arguably. Literally, when the dust settles. I mean, assuming Moscow and Beijing, Putin and Xi Jinping, don't come and militarily aid the Palestinians, because clearly all the allies of the Palestinians are being knocked out one by one. Do you think we will see Nuremberg-style trials of Biden, Harris, Blinken, Sullivan, Austin, Hochstein, in Europe, Starmer, von der Leyen, Macron, Scholz? These are the people, aren't they, all without whom this would not be possible.
I mean, if there is any justice in this world, then yes. But I don't, you know, I don't have a crystal ball and I don't know. I do know that these oligarchs, these Western oligarchs, this ruling elite who are pummeling this entire planet, and especially in our region, they're the ones who made all the rules, and they designed them to not hold themselves to account, which is why I think the ICC arrest warrants came as such a shock to everybody. Whether or not they will be held to account, you know, I don't know.
Yeah,
don't
Kareem know Khan's been on this. Account. Kareem Khan's been on this show, and yeah, he took his time. I don't know how many people were killed in the unprecedented waiting period for this warrant. You were talking about Kushner at the end of part one, Trump's son-in-law. Of course, Michigan went towards Trump, Arab Americans voted, because anything is better than someone like Holocaust Harris, arguably. Why do you think 74.5 million Americans still voted for Harris, knowing what was going on? I mean, you don't have to be a great supporter of Trump to realize you don't want to be supporting Kamala Harris, because that would make you complicit in genocide.
Yeah. I think Americans, well, first of all, I think one of the numbers that is often ignored in analyzing this election are the number of Americans who stayed home, who did not vote at all. There's over approximately 18 million people who voted in the previous election who just did not vote at all. I mean, that, to me, that is the most significant number that anybody should be looking at. And because I think it speaks to the feeling that Americans have that this political system does not represent anybody. It does not, there are no options for any of us in this election. Those who did vote, you know, the Americans are largely sort of ignorant of international politics and foreign policy. I think a lot of Americans don't view foreign policy as being as important as domestic policies. And that's why Harris campaigned so much on domestic issues.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, we're using words like Holocaust and genocide, and people talk about the Zone of Interest, that film about Auschwitz. And in that perspective, that's not really an excuse, isn't it? That's like literally talking about Nazis voting for Hitler or the larger German public. Why are Americans, clearly who can see, and certainly the younger generation, because we've seen mass protests and mass support for Palestine amongst young people in the United States. What is it about older American Democrats that think it's okay to vote for genocide? Politicians that advocate genocide?
So again, this is what I was trying to explain in my answer, is that there's a large portion of Americans who vote strictly on domestic policies, which was why, again, Harris was campaigning on identity politics in many ways. There's another portion of Americans who know what's happening and recognize that a genocide is taking place, but they voted for her nonetheless. And frankly, I think this is this kind of liberal establishment mentality that ultimately, you know, they'll say, oh, well, you know, genocide is bad, but they don't really, they don't mean it in the full weight of that word, because they don't really value Palestinian lives. Because if what's happening to us were happening to Jews, for example, it just would have been a no starter. But we are so dehumanized, and Arabs in particular, the West has been conditioned to accept our demise as if it were sort of an inevitability, that it is inevitable for us to live in chaos and disorder and despair. And that's how the American public has been conditioned for decades, through the media, through Hollywood, through book publishers. And so even those who might be dismayed or upset by the genocide, what they see does not carry the same visceral weight as it would if it were any other people, if it were Ukrainians, for example. So, because I don't think that we are perceived as fully human. They might feel sorry for it.
Ukrainians to support Zelensky at any rate. I mean, do you think Trump being elected will mean a reconfiguration of what goes by the left in the United States, then away from identity politics and back to anti-imperialism and class politics? Do you think that's one of the greatest things about a Trump victory, that the left will begin to understand, or are there very few signs so far that the Clintonite wing, I don't know, the whole of that establishment that also support Hollywood and propaganda media are going to be
I don't see signs of that, except when it comes to young people. I think one of the promising signs has been that not only are young people awakened to the criminality of Israel, but they have become awakened to the ways in which mass media has protected Israel and has obscured and obfuscated their crimes for so long. So there is a diminishing trust in Western media, which I think is probably the most important development for future generations in this country, to be mistrustful of this corporate Zionist media, frankly. And so they do look for alternative news sources. They look for independent media, and they look for alternative political analyses from intellectuals, not from basically entertainers who pose as journalists. So that, you know, that bodes well for the future. But, you know, what that means is difficult to really predict, because I also know that these oligarchs are quite resilient, and colonialism and imperialism just don't seem to sleep. But we'll see. I mean, you know, but the bottom line is there is this whole generation now that knows and recognizes Israel as a barbaric, genocidal Western invention.
Susan Ablowa, thank you.
Thank you, Afshan. Thanks for having me.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those surviving the UK-US-EU armed genocide here in this region. We'll be back with a brand new episode on Saturday. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV, on rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.